A mega prison in El Salvador is Exhibit A in President Bukele's hardline policy against gangs. Brutality is his point.
This image that he can jail his way out of a gang problem that has been going on for close to 5 decades now.
Also today, farmers make stunning political gains in the Netherlands, sweeping up a lot of non-farmer support along the way.
These citizens are very much dissatisfied and think that the farmer citizens movement will be better able to represent their interests.
And in Kolkata, India, fighting to make streetcars cool again.
People have an idea, though, this is from another century. It's not going to work here now.
Some transportation consultants say the tourist trolley system should be expanded, providing a greener way to get around a congested city. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. As the war in Ukraine grinds on, dwindling stockpiles of weapons have become a big concern for both sides. Today, a potential shift in the balance of power. Poland announced that it will begin sending Soviet-designed MiG fighter jets to Ukraine, just 4 or 5 to start. Small numbers, but powerful tools as Ukraine's military prepares for a spring offensive. Joining me to discuss this is retired U.S. Marine Colonel Mark Kansian. He's now a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Colonel Kansian, what details can you share with us on this fighter plane delivery right now?
Well, this is something that has been talked about for literally a year. The polls suggested this last spring. The United States pushed back, I think worried about a possible escalation. But over the course of the year, there's been a willingness to accept more risk. As a transfer, this makes a tremendous amount of sense. The Ukrainians already operate the MiG-29s so that they can incorporate these Polish jets very quickly into their armed forces. They have lost a number, an estimated 10. The Poles are sending 4 initially, but they have probably about 30 and likely would send all of those. It also helps the Poles because they're getting rid of a lot of Soviet-era equipment, and they're able to then replace it with NATO-standard, more contemporary equipment. And in fact, they're already making deals to get F-35s.
It does sound, though, like eventually getting rid of these MiGs is a goal. Does that mean they're just not kind of the best piece of gear on the market right now?
That's right. These are probably the 4 that are in the best condition. They may be refurbishing the rest of them. But although the Polish MiG-29s are an older kind of aircraft, what the Ukrainians have been doing and what the Poles may be doing now is upgrading these aircraft with NATO systems. We know that the Ukrainians have added what's called a HARM, which is an anti-radiation missile. They've integrated basically a NATO missile onto a Soviet aircraft. That's a way to give older equipment like MiG-29s more modern capabilities.
So what difference will these MiGs actually make?
They'll be a useful addition, and not particularly for air defense. The Ukrainians have been very concerned about air defense. The Russians have been using cruise missiles and these Iranian drones to attack, particularly the electrical infrastructure. This would be one more tool. They are not going to be decisive. There are no silver bullets in this war.
Well, given the hedging on delivering jets, specifically jets, to Ukraine out of concern that it'll be viewed by Russia as escalation, I guess the question is, will Russia see it that way?
Well, Russia will complain, but I expect that that's all they will do. I do expect that the United States and NATO will tell Ukraine not to use these for deep strikes into Russia that might precipitate escalation.
Do you think other countries will follow suit with fighter jets now that Poland has stepped in?
I think so. The Czechs have talked about providing some of their aircraft. I think there were probably a few more in the Eastern European countries. We've scrounged up all of the Soviet equipment that we could, I mean, literally around the world, because that's easy for Ukraine to incorporate.
I want to recognize that Poland was eager to give Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine, and now Poland is the first to give Ukraine fighter jets. Pretty serious equipment that Ukraine has been asking all of its allies to offer. What do you make of Poland being the one that steps up first?
There's a lot of history here that make the Poles nervous. The Russians invaded in 1919, 1920, 1921. They invaded again in 1939, again in 1944. The Poles remember this, so they are willing to take more risks and do more than other countries.
Markansian is a retired colonel with the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve. He's now a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Colonel, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
The Netherlands woke up to a stunning new political landscape this morning. Voters in yesterday's provincial elections turned out big time for the Farmers' Party. Just established in 2019, it's quickly gone from zero representatives in the Dutch Senate to now controlling 20% of the seats. The young party's success reveals the increasing polarization of Dutch politics, lawmakers and voters pushing back against European regulations. Sarah De Lange is a professor of political science at the University of Amsterdam. I asked her to explain how the farmer citizen movement got started.
It's a movement that initially emerged as a farmers' movement that opposed nitrogen legislation. Many farmers in the Netherlands will have to close their farms to conform to EU regulation about the amount of nitrogen that they put in the air and in the soil. But over the past couple of years, the movement has attracted also a lot of ordinary citizens. These citizens are very much dissatisfied with the political establishment in The Hague and think that the farmer citizens movement will be better able to represent their interests.
What is the connection then between the farmers and the non-farmers who must have been convinced that this movement somehow spoke to them?
Many of the supporters that are non-farmers live in the rural areas, live in peripheral areas of the Netherlands, and these are areas that have been neglected in some ways. There's fewer hospitals, fewer schools, less public transportation. And as a result, many of the citizens feel there that they are living in left behind places and that their interests are not represented.
So what do these election results, Sarah, tell us about the state of Dutch politics today?
As in previous elections, there's a very high share of political distrust and political dissatisfaction with the mainstream parties that have been governing over the past decades. The Farmers' Party picked up a lot of voters that previously voted, for example, for Thierry Baudet's Forum for Democracy, a populist radical right party, so that were already discontented and expressing that sentiment. It's only now that the sentiment is more clearly articulated along geographical lines as well.
I'm curious to know, in the Netherlands, how common is it for new political parties to form? Is it common?
Yes. So the Netherlands has the most accessible electoral system in the world. Parties get as many seats as they get votes. So if a party obtains the equivalent of one seat in national parliament, this is 0.67% of the votes, it's automatically represented. So it's very attractive for new parties to form. What's far more difficult for them, and what will also be a challenge for the Farmers' Party, is these parties tend to be short-lived. Gaining support is one thing, but maintaining support over time is another thing.
You know, interestingly, with these provincial elections, the Green Party, allied with the Labour Party, gained 15 seats, making them also a powerful player in the Senate. So these two opposite groups that made strides, the Greens and the Farmers, what does that do to the political middle in the Netherlands?
Prime Minister Rutte has maintained his support. His party did relatively okay in the elections. It's his coalition partners that did exceptionally poorly. The government coalition really needs to seek the support of either this Green Social Democratic Alliance or the Farmers' Party in the Senate in order to pass legislation. They will have to make concessions, either making policies more progressive or to make them more restrictive, traditional, to cater to the Farmers' Party.
And as for climate policy in the long run, do the Netherlands go their own way or do they follow European rules?
The Netherlands will continue to follow European rules, and this is also what's really challenging for the Farmers' Party. A lot of the things that they advocate for are simply not possible within the framework of EU regulation.
Sarah De Lange is a professor of political science at the University of Amsterdam. Thank you very much for helping us understand these election results.
You're welcome.
This year marks the 150th anniversary of the arrival of streetcars in Kolkata, India. They are cherished there in part because Kolkata is today the only city in India that still operates trams. Pressure is now coming from some local transport planners who feel that streetcars are an outdated idea for a congested metropolis. A group of activists, though, is fighting to save the trams and have found help far away in Australia. Sandeep Roy hopped aboard a Kolkata tram to bring us this story.
Australian Roberto De Andrea is an odd sight on a Kolkata streetcar heading towards the city's Esplanade neighborhood. Here he is calling out tram stops in Bengali. De Andrea used to be a connie or a tram conductor in Melbourne. He first came to Kolkata almost 30 years ago and heard a tram.
I could hear the gong, ding, 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 in the distance. So all I needed to do was follow the sound, and the sound is the same as the gong in Melbourne.
He found the streetcar workers, but there was a language barrier.
I didn't know any Bengali words. I'd pretended to ring the bell to drive the tram. I made the noise of the compressor, ching, 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 ching. The tram workers understood straight away.
That forged a friendship that's brought him back to Kolkata again and again, this year to celebrate 150 years of trams in Kolkata, with cake, music and a parade of gaily decorated old trams, led by a 100-year-old green wooden car. While kicking off the celebrations, Snehashish Chakraborty, the state transport minister, says trams are a green mode of transport in a polluted city, but the roads aren't getting wider and the number of cars keep rising.
It is not possible today to run tram every route in Kolkata metropolitan city due to congestion.
Many old tram routes have also been taken over by buses and three-wheelers who have huge political clout in the city. And the building of the underground metro has disrupted old tram routes, which weren't restored. But the minister promises trams will remain, at least as a heritage ride for tourists. Sitting in a bustling new cafe in a tram depot, transport consultant Suvendu Seth says trams should be for mass transport, not heritage.
I can put it the other way around. Why don't we make those roads which are narrow, make it for pedestrians and trams only? Why allow vehicles there?
He says many cities in Europe, Australia and America got rid of streetcars during the automobile boom of the 50s and 60s and are now bringing them back at great expense.
And we had it all the time and we are neglecting it. That's not a very nice thing. We should encourage it.
But the government talks more about buying fancy new electric buses than revamping the old electric trams it already has.
People have an idea that, oh, this is from another century. It's not going to work here now.
Roberto De Andrea and a band of local streetcar activists are trying to make trams cool again. Since 1996, every couple of years, they organize Tram Jatra, a sort of week-long traveling streetcar roadshow. Art college students paint them. There are talks and displays and bands performing in tram cars singing about them. But still, trams are just about hanging on in Kolkata. Only two routes are currently operational. At the tram terminus, a group of streetcar workers are raising slogans for resuming more services. There I meet a streetcar driver named Gopal Ram.
537 tram driver, 537.
His father Jagannath also worked here, as did his grandfather and great-grandfather, from the days when the cars were steam-powered.
Antu Ram, Mahavir Ram, Jagannath Ram, Gopal Ram.
Gopal Ram is retiring after 39 years of service. His son sees no future in the trams of Kolkata. For Gopal Ram, it's the end of the line. For The World, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata, India.
Just ahead, barrels of uranium went missing in Libya. Now there are claims they've been found. We'll learn more next on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A worrying development in Libya, nuclear material gone missing. So says the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. The UN's nuclear watchdog reported that 10 barrels of uranium ore disappeared. Then, this afternoon, the barrels were found near the border with Chad. That's according to armed forces in eastern Libya. The IAEA has not been able to verify this. With us to tell us more is Scott Roker. He's vice president of the Nuclear Material Security Program at the Nuclear Threat Initiative and joins us from Washington. Scott, what do we know about how the uranium went missing?
There's not a whole lot of details yet about how the material went missing, but I do know that the facility itself is located in a really remote part of Libya, just outside the city of Sabha, where there's literally no electricity to that facility at all. So there's no alarms, no physical protection there. The security at that site was very poor to begin with.
Is the claim of Libya's Eastern Forces credible that these barrels have been located?
It's hard to confirm at the moment. The part of the message that concerns me the most is the fact that they found this material on the border with Chad, which indicates to me that someone was trying to move this outside of the country. And the real question is, why were they trying to do that and where was it going?
So the late dictator Muammar Gaddafi renounced his WMDs in the 2000s. Is it understood where this 2.5 tons of uranium actually came from?
Yeah, it was a well-known spot in the southern part of the country, and the International Atomic Energy Agency did have inspectors there at various points over the last decade or so to check on the security of that material. This is essentially the leftover portion of the weapons program under Gaddafi, basically the feedstock, the type of uranium that you would put into centrifuge to enrich to a point where you could put it into a nuclear weapon.
Right. So it's not currently enriched.
That's correct. This is uranium ore, or sometimes known as yellow cake. This is not a material that you could use in a nuclear weapon in its current form. Really, the material right now is not that big of a threat.
I mean, missing uranium or any kind of metals with nuclear properties, this is the nightmare scenario best-selling novels are built around. In real life, what are the concerns if material like this were to fall into the wrong hands?
Yeah, fortunately enough, this is not the most sensational novel that you'll read, because this material cannot be used in a nuclear weapon in its current form. So there would be a bit of a lead time until the material could actually be converted into weapons usable form. So, you know, a non-state actor getting its hands on this type of material is not a major concern. It's more of the state actor.
The fact that this happened in Libya, a country where the government is in disarray at the moment, how does that change the equation in your view, even if, as some reports suggest, uranium has been located?
Yeah, it's a troubling situation, and it has been for years. This particular area of Libya is pretty well ungoverned. There are a couple local tribes that have fought over this area. ISIS at one point had control of this area. And so the fracturing of Libya's government only adds to the vulnerability of this material.
Finally, and we know, Scott, this story is still moving. Are there any leading theories as to who might have taken the material?
My guess would be that someone local would take the material and try to perhaps sell it to someone who is interested. A worst case scenario is that there's another state actor out there who is trying to acquire this material. This material isn't particularly valuable. This material is valued around $300,000 on the open market. So it's not particularly valuable. You know, so for a country to try to acquire this illicitly means that they have some nefarious reason for trying to acquire it.
Scott Roker is the vice president of the Nuclear Material Security Program at the Nuclear Threat Initiative. He joined us from Washington. Scott, thanks very much. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
TV soap operas produced in Asia are popular across the region, but it's the so-called K-dramas out of South Korea that really dominate. There is, however, a relatively new subgenre of soaps produced in Thailand, and they're starting to attract new fans across Asia. From Bangkok, the world's Patrick Nguyen has that story.
There's this new-ish show in Thailand about a young single man who brings a stray cat into his apartment. And the cat, stick with me, transforms into a cute guy who follows the man around and nuzzles him like a cat. That's the cat guy saying, "Let's take a nap together." And then, "Oh my," he says, "are you blushing?" The show is titled Meow Ears Up. It's part of a new wave of soaps called BL dramas. That's short for boy love. Other countries make BL dramas, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, but Thailand leads the pack. Some of the other BL shows are called Rainbow Lagoon or Secret Crush on You. They all pretty much follow the same format.
It focuses on the romantic or homoerotic relationship between two men.
Puwen Bunyawechachiwen is a scholar at Thailand's Thammasat University who has studied BL dramas and what they mean to society. He says all types of people watch these shows, but they're made with a specific audience in mind, and it's not gay men.
Yes, the main audience are heterosexual female, young female.
He says BL shows are usually written by straight women with other straight women in mind. Professor Pu Nguyen says in a traditional Thai soap opera with a male and female lead, the person watching at home might develop a playful crush on the leading man, but they might not want to share him with the leading lady.
They feel that that woman in the television should not take this boy of mine.
This boy of mine, he says. And that's why BL dramas are so popular. The viewer can crush on two guys, not feeling threatened by either. These shows are always PG-13, if not PG. You'll see longing glances, a little tickling, shirts coming off, but not much else. Here's another scene from Meow Ears Up, where the two guys lay in bed, sweetly reminiscing about the night they met. They talk and cuddle, then fall asleep. It's very tame. Daytime soaps get much more racy. Professor Pu Nguyen says the BL genre is also a sharp break from other LGBTQ films and shows made in Thailand. There's a rich tradition here of using cinema to express a message about life as a gay person in Thailand.
It reflects the reality of society where sexual minorities are not accepted.
Mostly not accepted by older generations. BL shows, on the other hand, pure escapism. There's no message at all, just guys with amazing hair blushing and flirting. These soaps have so much commercial appeal that even Thailand's right-wing government is getting involved. It's hosting trade fairs to boost the industry, with Thai diplomats promoting BL shows as a cultural export. Professor Bunyawechichiwin says he never expected Thai government support for gay-friendly shows.
This is impossible 10 years ago. We could not even thinking about this. It's impossible.
The government has, in recent years, talked about legalizing same-sex marriage. Police still crack down on political dissent, but Professor Pu Nguyen says promoting LGBTQ issues does help officials show their tolerant side. He says they're sending a message.
Look at the BL drama here. We give more freedom in terms of gender and sexuality.
But these TV dramas probably don't need the government's help. 30 new BL shows debuted last year, and this year is set to have even more. The latest BL show, Moonlight Chicken, is about a chef who makes chicken and rice getting charmed by a handsome customer. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
We will be right back with more in the next half hour. You're listening to The World. City of light, city of love, city of trash. Garbage collectors in Paris walk off the job in opposition to plans to raise the retirement age. It is a mess.
The winds have also been really intense lately, so there's garbage littering the streets and actually flying in the air.
And think about the smell. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Officials in El Salvador released a video this week that's intended to be disturbing and reassuring. In it, you see more than 2,000 suspected criminals, bare-chested, heads bowed, filing to El Salvador's new mega prison. The cowering prisoners are barefoot and handcuffed under the watchful eye of guards. The inmates are forced to sit on the floor with their legs locked, their bodies pressed up against one another. This brand new mega prison is part of Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele's tough anti-gang policies. Stephen Dudley, co-director of Insight Crime, has been following developments in El Salvador closely. Stephen, the images in this video are grim. Many of these suspects have not had a trial. The president's supporters say his tough strategy has gotten gang members off the street, though, and made crime-plagued neighborhoods safer. Have they?
Listen, the tough view that he gave us in terms of these prisoners being filed in is exactly what he wants to project. This image that he can jail his way out of a gang problem that has been going on for close to 5 decades now. That is exactly the idea. Project this idea that you are winning this war, so to say. And in certain respects, there have been elements of the current phase of what is a 5-decade-long battle that he has shown progress in. I mean, certainly areas that used to be gang-ridden, we are getting reports out of them that say they are not nearly as much. People can go to school again. work again, play soccer after school again, those sorts of everyday things. But in terms of winning this over the long term, that is a huge question mark still.
And the underlying conditions that let the gangs make money and grow, like drugs and kidnapping, those things have not been addressed. Is that correct? And are these security gains then real?
That is absolutely correct. The underlying conditions that lead to the proliferation of these gangs, both in places like El Salvador and different parts of Central America and the United States where these gangs were born. So, you know, it's hard to believe that this particular strategy will show any long-term impacts different from what we have seen in the past, which is that the gangs, once inside these prisons, especially large prisons, reorganize, regroup, reset the table, if you will, often within their own organizations, become more mature criminal organizations. That is what has happened in the past. I'm not saying that'll happen in the future, but that is certainly the pattern to date.
Right. So are the Salvadorans you've spoken with, Stephen, okay with the trade-off of fundamental human rights for the security they have been asking for?
Absolutely. First of all, the president is very popular, and that is a reflection of the popularity of, in particular, this security policy. And I don't necessarily think that they are framing it in that manner as a trade-off in many respects, nor are they thinking of how much power this is bequeathing to the Bukele administration itself, which has long-term plans to, in essence, take over that country for a very long time to come.
Practically speaking, isn't it really expensive to implement these mano duro, these iron fist policies? I mean, we're talking this mega prison. It's not just a huge prison. It must be a massive investment in security forces.
This particular prison alone is supposed to take up to 40,000 prisoners.
Wow.
Now, they weren't able to control the 40,000 prisoners that were spread about in many different prisons across the country. So there's very little reason to believe that a prison of 40,000, which would be equal to the entire prison population pre these special presidential decrees, would have any greater success than all these bunches of other prisons had before them.
What about any plans for rehabilitation of these gang members? Has the government addressed that?
They have not. In fact, if you look at some of the fine print from the government about this, the whole idea of this prison and others where a lot of the most formidable gang members go is that they will be harsh. And by harsh, I mean 23 hours without light. Very few toilets, showers, little access to family members, often little access to the most basic necessities, which is really where the gangs have always filled the gaps. So you can't get a toothbrush or a blanket. Maybe you might be able to get one via your gang contact inside of prisons, which is how they build these gangs up in the first place.
So how then do critics see the sustainability of Bukele's strategy? I mean, can Salvadoran officials just keep dealing with the problem by incarcerating gang members?
Well, I'm certain that Bukele, who is a master, along with his team, of image, of projecting an image of this kind of cool, strongman, democratic leader, will continue to project that image. Whether or not we're going to get the truth behind these walls, because at this point, all we have seen are the government images. These are propaganda images. They're meant to leave us with a certain impression of, you know, young tattooed brown men who are being thrown into jail, and that's going to resolve your issue. That is what is being projected. But is that going to lead into any long-term effects? Well, we'll have to see. You know, according to what we've seen over history, probably not.
Stephen Dudley is the co-director of the nonprofit journalism and investigative group Insight Crime. Thanks for being with us, Stephen.
Thank you, Marco.
Over the past 5 years, more than 7 million people have fled Venezuela because of political chaos and economic instability. Large numbers of those migrants have been arriving at the U.S. southern border. Venezuelans have also headed to Brazil, where some 400,000 have arrived at its northern border. Once in Brazil, many Venezuelans struggle to find jobs and learn Portuguese. Reporter Gisele Regatao visited the home of one Venezuelan family that has settled in the city of Sao Paulo. For now,
The further you go on the Emerald Line of the train, the more it sounds like a street market. Vila Natal is the last stop. It's about 80 miles south of downtown. This is one of the enclaves of Venezuelan migrants in São Paulo, like the family of Yoselin Calcurian. She has three kids. Santiago is 13, Sofia is 9, and here's the little one.
Josue!
Josue is 4. This used to be a one-bedroom apartment. They converted the kitchen into a second bedroom and created a cooking area outside. Calcurian is 35 years old. She has dark, straight hair, brown eyes, and smiles a lot. She used to work as a school secretary in Ciudad Bolívar, in eastern Venezuela. She says it was very hard to survive, even though she owns a house there. Our whole salary would go towards food, and it would only last for 3 days. For the rest of the month, we needed to figure out how to buy groceries again, she says. She left Venezuela in June of 2021. Her husband didn't want to come, so she grabbed her kids and left him behind. He kept saying that if he was going to struggle, he wanted to struggle in his own country. And I said, you can go ahead and struggle in your country, because I'm leaving, she says. 1 week later, her husband left Venezuela too. But they didn't reunite until months later. Calcurian and her kids spent 3 months in shelters in the north of Brazil. I asked her why she chose to move to the neighborhood of Vila Natal in São Paulo. I didn't choose it. When they were placing us, they asked if we had anyone who would host us. We didn't have anyone. We don't know anyone here, she says. A shelter in Vila Natal had free spots. That's why Calcurian came here. Journeys like hers happen every day in Brazil. According to the Brazilian Federal Police, in February, the country received 40% more Venezuelans than the same month last year. The numbers are overwhelming. Carolina Nunes is the manager of operations and partnerships at the nonprofit Refugio 343 in Brazil. We weren't prepared to receive such a large number of migrants, and people don't stop coming, she says. It's really a crisis that keeps happening and doesn't stop, she says. Refugio 343 helps migrants with education, health services, and they partner with companies to find people jobs. Brazil has an unemployment rate of 7.9%. That's half of what it was in 2020, but that doesn't mean migrants can get good jobs.
Hoje em dia, os brasileiros não querem mais trabalhar para abate em frigorífico, daí...
Nunes says many migrants end up working in the meatpacking industry. Yoselin Calcurian's husband has one of those jobs. He works at a chicken processing plant in São Paulo. Calcurian herself is unemployed. She used to work remotely selling ads in Spanish, but she was laid off last year. She hasn't been able to find a new job. I lost some jobs because I can't speak Portuguese well, she says. Venezuelans here can get residency and work permit or apply for refugee status if they intend to stay in Brazil permanently. She doesn't. Her oldest son, Santiago Lopez, is studying computer programming, and he says he wants to go back to Venezuela as well. He has a different dad than his younger siblings, and he misses him. He's also struggling to adapt to Brazilian culture. It's so different. If I were to tell you, I would spend 3 hours doing so, he says. Women like Yoselin Calcurian are changing the demographics of migration in Brazil. Talita Yamamoto coordinates service to refugees at Caritas, the relief agency of the Catholic Church. It's a lot of women. Because of the Venezuelan migration, in 2021, we served more women than men for the first time, she says. In the last year or two, she says federal funding has decreased and private donations are down too. Everybody's a bit tense, wondering how this is going to work, she says. I first met Calcurian in January, and since then I've been checking in with her via WhatsApp. Every time I send her a message, she says they are well, and she asks about me and my family too. Last time we spoke was earlier this week. Four more of her family members had just arrived in São Paulo from Venezuela. She told me they decided to move to a smaller city in the southern state of Santa Catarina. They think it might be easier to get jobs there. We have to fight because it's hard here, so we have to try someplace else, she says. Again, the women will lead the way. At the end of April, Calcurian is planning on moving with her kids. Her husband will follow later. For The World, I'm Gisele Regatao, Vila Natal, São Paulo, Brazil.
Vanessa Regatao contributed to this report. Here's a sobering fact. In the past few years, global cocaine production has gone up 35%. That's according to a new report released today by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. The sharp increase can be explained by changes in both supply and demand. There's more cocaine being produced more efficiently, and across the globe, more people who want it. Antoine Vella is a researcher and analyst on cocaine markets and the lead author of the UN's new report. So the 35% increase in cocaine production, Antoine, happened between 2020 and 2021. That was during the pandemic. So with so many transport links and borders shut down, how did that happen? And what is the connection to the pandemic?
So the effect of the COVID pandemic was actually, in a way, indirectly may have facilitated rather than hindered the coca bush cultivation. For example, one of the effects, especially in Bolivia and Peru, was the obstacles it created for law enforcement officers to carry out eradication efforts, which indirectly means that farmers had more opportunity to cultivate coca bush. And there's also other socioeconomic factors which come into play. But the other side of the coin there was that for a short period of time, there were some obstacles in terms of the ability of buyers to meet sellers within countries like Bolivia and Peru. So this created some hiccups in the early stages of the supply chain, but it didn't directly affect cultivation. It may have more affected the processing and trafficking of the substance. But in any case, all of these effects were rather short-lived, and there was an underlying surge, increasing trend, which can be traced back further than 2020. And the COVID pandemic simply caused some disruptions there, but ultimately, it did not really change the bottom line.
Those are fair points you make, but isn't it possible, given the opaqueness of cartels, that we just don't know the real numbers on the production side?
On the production side, we have pretty solid monitoring systems. We engage in fully fledged monitoring exercises which use satellite imaging. For sure, there's a lot of things that we don't know about the supply chain, but production per se is something we believe we have a pretty good handle on in the three countries where it occurs, which is Colombia, Bolivia, and Peru.
So the report talks about how cartels are developing new transport hubs in different parts of the globe. What have been the traditional hubs and where are the new ones?
So the traditional routes, for example, may involve trafficking directly from Colombia towards the United States via Central America or via maritime routes, and also using air routes, and also towards Europe, for example, from Brazilian ports towards Europe and a smaller extent to Africa. Some of the newer routes we have observed include, for example, the Southern Cone route from Peru and Bolivia towards Paraguay, and then downward using the Paraná-Paraguay waterway to the Atlantic Ocean. Another development has to do with Southeastern Europe and Turkey, which seem to be receiving more cocaine now. Moreover, I should mention that there is a rebound, a strong rebound in cocaine trafficking through West Africa towards Europe, either via maritime routes or across the Sahel towards North Africa, and then from there, presumably either to Europe or towards the Middle East.
Colombia, Bolivia, and Peru, they've traditionally been the largest producers of cocaine. Is that still the case?
That is absolutely still the case. They account for virtually all the documented cultivation of coca bush. However, there are indications of experimental cultivation in Central America.
What are the emerging markets for cocaine? Where is the growth area for the cartels?
First of all, South America itself has a big consumer base. Western Central Europe has caught up in some senses with the United States. Then there's also, for example, Africa, which is very much exposed now because of the routes through Africa. There's also some countries in Asia, particularly Japan, India, Hong Kong. Basically, the Americas and Western Central Europe together account for about 3/4 of the world's cocaine users, but they only really account for about 1/5 of the world's population. But this leaves a huge potential for expansion in places like Asia and Africa.
Antoine Vella researches global cocaine markets at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. He's the lead author of a new report that shows global cocaine production has gone up 35% in the last 2 years. Antoine, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much to you.
Imagine that 1 month ago you went shopping for $100 worth of groceries. Then today you go to the same store to buy the exact same stuff, except now it runs you $117. That is how much food prices have jumped in Spain, and there seems to be no end in sight. One result, people are bypassing more expensive items like organic food. As Jerry Haddon reports from the outskirts of Barcelona, the business of eco-friendly food is starting to take a hit.
There are at least a couple of ways to protect early spring potatoes from weeds. You can spray on herbicide, or you can bury the weeds under dirt, suffocating them before they choke your spuds. That's what organic farmer Ferran Barangay is doing. He's up in his blue John Deere tractor, pushing more earth on top of his rows of potato seedlings. The weeds will pop back up again, he says, but by then the potatoes will be big enough to survive. We might do one more pass before harvest, he says. This is the organic farmer's struggle, he says, battling weeds manually. Chemicals would be cheaper, Barangay says, but his five-acre operation is 100% organic. As for sales, they're dropping. Have my sales slipped? Yeah, for sure, he says. We haven't raised prices much, but people are spending less because prices are up everywhere. Rents, heating costs, gasoline, the spike in the cost of living is brutal, he says. No one's immune to it. In fact, a new study suggests more than half of Spaniards who used to spend extra on organic food are now saying no to the bio beans and pesticide-free peppers. Just down the road from Barangay's plot, shopper Montse Font is leaving an organic food shop. In her bag, 3 pears and some coconut oil. I'm spending a bit less here, she says. It depends on your wallet, but inflation is putting the brakes on my shopping. Inside the store Font's just left, the mood is somber. There's just one other shopper inside, browsing the aisles of organic oats and pasta, the fresh produce. The owner is in her back office. She doesn't want to give her name or the name of her store, because she's trying to sell it. Sales are down 10%, she says, and she thinks things are going to get worse. In fact, she says, a farmer who opened up his own farm-to-table store nearby had to close recently. If a grower can't do it, she says, imagine how tough it is for a retailer like me. The woman says when she opened this place 13 years ago, most people didn't know what organic was. Creating the market was like chipping away at stone, she says. Little by little, we carved out our niche. But now, she says, the big stores have gotten in on the action, which has also hurt us. In recent years, lots of supermarkets in Europe have expanded their organic offerings. One German chain, Lidl, now lists about 8% of the food at its Spanish stores as bio or organic, says Juan Carlos Gasquez Abad, a marketing professor at the University of Almería. But he says he thinks today's inflationary cycle could reverse that trend.
Una de las consecuencias de la crisis económica y de la incapacidad económica de muchos consumidores.
As consumers are losing buying power, he says, the larger companies may just abandon the organic market. That'd mean less supply, which will drive prices even higher, he says, pushing organic food further out of reach for consumers. Gasquez Abad says it's a vicious circle that could set the organic food movement back years. Those who may survive this crisis, small producers. The ones who don't have high infrastructure or fuel costs. Take Ramon Camps. He's an engineer by day. At night and on weekends, he tends to his 600 olive trees on the outskirts of Barcelona. He shows me around one evening, after dark. You can barely make out the trimmed trees with their silvery leaves.
And these are the cuts that I've done.
Like the potato farmer Ferran Barangay, Camps says producing organic food locally on a small scale is a more stable, if less lucrative, way to farm. Olive oil prices are way up this year in Spain, but Camps isn't worried about that, he says, because he's not targeting the masses in stores.
I think the volumes I have, you know, my friends, they put money on the table, so they do want it. There's more buyers than production for what I do.
For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
The French president has spoken. The retirement age in France will now be 64, up from 62. Emmanuel Macron pushed through a bill moments before the National Assembly chamber was set to vote. Macron did not have the numbers, so he pushed the bill through using special constitutional powers. Opposition lawmakers booed, shouted, and sang the French national anthem. They have until tomorrow to request a vote of no confidence. For nearly 2 months, the pension debate has been met with widespread strikes and protests across France. You can see the impacts. In Paris, you can smell the impacts. Trash collectors went on strike more than a week ago. We reached out to Gabby Pedriani, an American living in Paris, to hear what it's like there.
I live in the 5th arrondissement in the left bank of Paris, and the garbage hasn't been picked up in over a week now. The guardians of the apartment buildings have taken all of the bins out of the building courtyards and put them into the streets and just left them there. So at first it started with the bins on the sidewalk, but at this point things have gotten extremely messy. Bags and bags of garbage are overflowing out of the bins, and there are loose pieces of trash literally everywhere. In many places, the piles are also stacked extremely high. And now more and more, you can't walk down the sidewalk because it's so entirely full of trash. The winds have also been really intense lately, so there's garbage littering the streets and actually flying in the air. Public trash bins are surrounded by bags that have been fully filled and then emptied and just set next to the bin. So it's a very clear, extremely literal reminder of an essential job that a lot of us forget about on a day-to-day basis. Now crows, which Paris is full of, are pecking apart the bags, and the contents are beginning to spill out all over the sidewalk. A couple days ago, the smell started, and now you can barely breathe in without smelling the stench of rotting food. The fear now is that the rat problem, which is already tricky in Paris, especially in the parks, will get out of control. On Monday, I actually saw a crow eating a dead rat near a pile of garbage, so not a great omen. As someone who moved to Paris from the East Village of New York City, I generally find Paris to be a very clean city by comparison, so seeing it like this has been truly shocking.
That's Gabby Pedriani in Paris. Garbage collectors say they will continue their strike through the weekend, at least.
April in Paris. Chestnuts in blossom.
Well, we're not going to unsee that crow eating a dead rat. Get us out of here, Ella. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for listening.